Good morning, this is Bishop Phoebe Rofe of the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee, and welcome to Faithfully Memphis. Every Thursday morning, we broadcast on WYXR 91.7 FM out of Crosstown Concourse in Memphis, and we have an opportunity to talk with an interesting guest to learn more about their work and the role of faith in their life. And we always begin the show with a segment called The Saint of the Day. And this week, we want to remember Lucy of Syracuse, who was actually killed for her faith in the year 304. She was martyred at Syracuse, which is in modern-day Sicily, during a period where there were great persecutions against early members of the Christian community. And actually, her tomb is still located in the catacombs at Syracuse in Sicily. We don't know a lot about the details of Lucy's life, but she's really remembered for the purity of her life and the gentleness of her spirit. And her name means light, so she is often considered the patron saint of anyone who may be suffering from diseases of the eyes. I think Lucy really gained prominence in the early years of the church because her feast day was for many centuries the shortest day of the year. That changed when Pope Gregory VIII in 1582 shifted the calendar around. But prior to that, Lucy's feast day was the day that light began gradually returning and the days got longer. And so in households in Europe, when they celebrated the Feast of Lucy, they would invite a young girl in the family to dress in white as a symbol of Lucy's faith, purity, and her martyrdom. And they would invite this young girl to wear a crown of lighted candles upon her head. That seems a little scary to me. Maybe today we would actually use one of those candles that has the battery in it. But they actually would use lit candles, a sign that on Lucy's feast day, the light is returning. And the young girl would serve her family special foods prepared for the day. So December 13th is the feast day of Lucy of Syracuse, and we continue to remember her because men and women, young and old, died for their belief in Jesus. And here in America, we are really privileged to be able to fully live into our faith without fear of the types of persecution that Christians in other generations experienced. So we give thanks for Lucy of Syracuse and those other faithful folks known only to God alone who suffered and sacrificed to continue Christian discipleship. So welcome back to Faithfully Memphis. Our special guest today is Mark Hackett, the Executive Director of Operation Broken Silence. Mark is a native Memphian, and in 2007, he was an aspiring culinary arts student, and I believe he met a Sudanese genocide survivor. And that meeting, I think, really changed Mark's life and led him to found Operation Broken Silence in 2011. This is a nonprofit organization focused on three areas: storytelling and movement building, education and healthcare, and grassroots advocacy, all with the purpose of empowering the Sudanese people. Mark's favorite part of the work is the people that he gets to interact with. And he's also publicly shared his faith as a Christian and how that impacts his work and his worldview. And we want to explore that as part of this conversation. But Mark, welcome to Faithful Memphis.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here. Wonderful. So, can you share a little bit about the role of faith in your childhood when you were growing up? Did you grow up in the church?
So I grew up in a conservative evangelical church, very prevalent here in the South. But it was more of the intellectual side of evangelicalism, not a lot of the cultural things we see coming out of that tradition today. And at the same time, I saw some of those cultural things growing up, especially at school. That was sometimes a very jarring experience for me because I would meet people who said they were evangelical but have a very different outlook
Perspective than yours,
and approach to mine. And but yeah, growing up in a place that leaned more towards the intellectual side of things, also a lot of missions work and charitable work. As I grew up, wanted to be a culinary arts student. The high school I went to had a great culinary program, and I found a lot of joy in that, and still cook some today, not as much as I'd like to. But then I met someone from Sudan and heard his story. He was from the Darfur region, which is Western Sudan. At that point, the genocide was still pretty heavily going on there. He had lost most of his family in that. He had fled to Chad and eventually ended up here as a refugee. And his story just really blew my mind. I was like, how is this not on the news? How have I never heard of this? This seems like one of the biggest stories happening in the world today. And I didn't know much about it. No one around me knew much about it. And along the way, discovered we have a very large Sudanese community here in Memphis. And so got linked up with them, started learning more about where they came from and their stories, which a lot of them were very similar. And eventually started making the journey over to Sudan. And that's really where I think my faith journey has gone through a transition through those early trips. Seeing how deep human suffering can be, the reality that we are born into situations that are very unfair, and that set certain people up for failure just because of the way they look or where they're from or what they believe. You can be born into environments where those things can, because of the broader government or the culture around you, those things can work against you. In the church, we say persecution a lot, oppression. Those words are very, very familiar to the Sudanese.
So you and I share the experience of having been to Sudan. I got connected because my alma mater, Virginia Theological Seminary, always has international students. And one of their students ended up being the Bishop of Rink, which is in the southern part of the country. And so when I went in 2007, that was before they had divided the country into Sudan and South Sudan. And so flying into Khartoum, I'd have to say that airport is one of the scariest places I've been in my life. And just driving south on the one paved road and getting to Rink to actually teach Sudanese priests who had been ordained when they were in the refugee camps in Ethiopia, having walked there, which is crazy, because they were great speakers and preachers, but they hadn't gotten the intellectual or academic side of it. And so that bishop had approached Virginia Theological Seminary about sending seminarians there to sort of, after the fact, help equip these men and women, because he was also ordaining women to be better priests and pastors. And it was a transformational experience for me. And I just wonder, what was it in particular that struck you about the people? Because I fell in love with the people.
Something I'm hearing you say, and that is there's something about Sudan that once you've been, it never leaves
It
you.
doesn't.
And I thought about that a lot over the years and agree that it's the people. The people we work with, especially in Sudan, historically, if you've been Black in Sudan, if you've been Christian in Sudan, if you've wanted an education, if you're a journalist, if you're a pastor, you know, whatever, all those things put a target on your back.
Correct.
And a lot of the people we work with in Sudan are all of those things.
Right.
So they've had multiple targets on their back.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, meeting those people, seeing the environment they've come out of, going into one of the war zones, mm-hmm. And into the refugee camps, and seeing, yes, the pain and the suffering, but also this resilience and this refusal to give up in the face of all of it. If there's a group of people in the world who at this point would say, like, we're done,
mm-hmm.
like, we either want our own country or we're just going to move out of this place, like, I mean, these people probably have the right to do that. And they haven't. They've chosen to stay and try to turn this thing around.
Yeah.
And there's something about that type of hope that the hope that's in your bones, I guess, that's very contagious, and and you want to do anything you can to help those people succeed as best they can.
Yeah, I think the depth of joy,
yes,
and the conviction of their faith was
yes.
just humbling. And I was there ostensibly as right the teacher, the yeah. professional, but of course, as always happens, I learned
yes.
far more than anything I conveyed. You know, when I was there in 2007, that version of the Civil War had recently ended.
Yeah.
And so there's this one paved road going south. And then once you get to Rink, you know, there's no running water.
Yes.
There's very limited electricity. Mm-hmm. There are no hospitals.
Yeah.
There's no trash collection. I mean, all of the things that we just take for granted in terms of infrastructure
yeah.
here in the West, they don't have. And so we ended up staying with the family of a priest who was the head of the school that where I was teaching at that time, because of course there are no hotels.
Yeah.
And it was so, you know, humbling. You know, you fill up your bucket with boiling water that a woman has sort of warmed up, and you just pour it over your head, and that's how you shower. And you know, the regular Sudanese bathroom, for those of you who haven't been, is like a little tiny room with a hole in the ground.
Yep.
And there's no running water, there's no electricity. You have to have really good thigh muscles because you just have to squat. But they were nice enough, knowing two Americans were coming over, to just place a toilet bowl on top of the hole.
Yeah.
And then in order for us to flush it, we had to take water from a bucket and pour it down.
Yeah.
So I remember for several years when I came back from that experience, being so mindful of like turning off light switches and not
yes.
letting water run, and just realizing how much privilege I have
yeah.
that I can walk into my house and turn on a light switch and turn on a faucet.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah. And also, because I mean, we see this in a lot of the work we do is very education focused.
Yes.
In all of my trips to Sudan, talking to rebel commanders in the area we work with, farmers, pastors, imams, the one thing that comes up over and over again is education.
Yes.
Because the schools have been destroyed in the war. You know, the teachers have fled to refugee camps following their students.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have schools everywhere. We have public schools. We
right.
have private schools. We have homeschools. we have universities. We have all these educational experiences. And there, you know, the two schools that we sponsor need a refugee camp. You know, last year there was a wait list of over 1,000 students to get in
wow.
those schools. And those are just the two schools that we support.
Right.
And, you know, coming back over the years, that's something I've been mindful of, especially I speak in school environments and universities mm-hmm. a lot. It's just like, we get to just walk in buildings where teaching just happens
right.
and people get paid to do this.
Right.
And, you know, some students pay to come to this. Some, you know, it's provided, you know, publicly, and it's just so available to us.
Right. And we almost take it for granted.
Yeah. And there it's not.
Yeah. So give us a sense of some of the projects that Operation Broken Silence is really involved in right now.
Yeah. So, you know, I was just talking about education.
Mm-hmm.
So our flagship program, so Anita Refugee Camp, which sits on the Sudan-South Sudan border,
mm-hmm.
There's about 50,000 people living there today. When we first got involved there was about 250,000 people living
oh, wow.
there. And throughout these past several years, we've been the only nonprofit in the world that supports community-led education in EDA.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we go into EDA, we find Sudanese teachers and say, what can we provide to you to help what you're trying to do grow?
Okay.
And meet the needs of more students, and then try to get out of their way as fast as we can. Because, I mean, you've been to Sudan. These people are highly motivated.
Oh, very like, much so.
They don't need me getting out of their way.
And so resilient.
Yeah.
My spirit would have been crushed by a fraction of what they've experienced.
Yeah. And so when we first started, you know, we found four teachers in EDA who were teaching under a tree with half a chalkboard that had been broken. Mm-hmm. You know, students didn't have pencils or paper. They were just trying to make it work. And we're like, this seems like a great place to start.
Yeah.
Because here are four teachers who are just trying to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was several years ago. Today, we have Endure Primary School and Renewal Secondary School in EDA, 24 teachers combined, serving about 1,400 students a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a testament to, I mean, we've raised the money to help mm-hmm. make that happen, but it's really a testament to the teachers that we found in EDA and helping them get things back on track.
Got it.
Our second kind of big program bucket over there is healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
There's one hospital, Mother of Mercy Hospital. It's in the middle of the Nuba Mountains, which is the war affected area that we're in. They have 435 beds for a population of about 1 million people. So there's not enough money you can throw at this place. they've always needed all the help they can get. And so, for example, in 2019, they served between the hospital and a string of community clinics they had, they served over 150,000 people.
With 435 beds.
everything from vaccines to bringing new children into the world to cancer treatment. I mean, this place is just, it is insane what they're able to do with so little. So those are the two big areas we focus on, education and healthcare. Those are obviously two building blocks of any society.
Right. Right.
But we were led to those places because we met Sudanese on the ground there. Again, high level rebel commanders mm-hmm. who are just trying to keep their people safe, to the ordinary farmer and everyone in between. You said education, healthcare, education, mm-hmm. healthcare, education, mm-hmm. healthcare. And we've just kind of followed their guidance into those places. And it's really been humbling to see, with frankly the minimal resources we provided, how far they've been able to take and grow right. things and help people.
Right. So, I mean, I would imagine that some of these situations could be a little scary. You're talking about sort of rebel commanders. I mean, what do you have a spiritual practice or a spiritual discipline that sort of helps you enter into this situation that's so far outside of our regular comfort zone?
Yeah. So my first trip over to Sudan was in 2012.
Okay.
So at that point, the war in the Nuba Mountains had been going on for about a year. Mm-hmm. And those first 2 years of the war were really, really brutal.
Right.
That's when something like 20% of the entire Nuba population had fled
right.
the area. It was a massive group of people coming out. And on that trip, that was my first time to eat a refugee camp, which at that point was just booming in size.
Right.
So many people, so 1,000 people coming in a day at one point. And we crossed the border into the war zone, technically illegally.
Yeah.
The Sudanese government has never wanted outsiders to come in and see what they're doing. I remember right when we were about to drive in, the night before, you could hear the bombing happening across the border, and just thinking in my head, like, what have I gotten myself like, what have I gotten myself into? But as we started driving, you know, this kind of peace just came over me of like, I am in such a position of utter powerlessness right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a taste of what these people
they live with.
Were living through.
Yeah.
And realizing, like, if there's ever been a time where I've been completely in God's hands, like, this is it. And I just have to trust that he's going to keep me safe. And if not, if this is my time to go, like, you know, that's not my decision.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm here to figure out what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to help. So I just need to focus on that.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean trips like that have been easy or times they haven't been scary. Like, I've seen especially in those first few years, warplanes flying over and jumping into foxholes with all the people living there. Right. That is a surreal experience. But again, you know, the resilience of the people there, and, you know, while it's sad to see kind of the casualness of like, oh, there's a warplane, we go to the foxhole, and that's just what we do.
Right.
You know, there's something definitely really painful about that.
Yeah.
But there's something also beautiful about like, hey, there's this bad thing that's happening to us, but like, we're going to focus on that as actually little as possible.
Yes.
And how do we lift ourselves up?
Yes.
Here. And so, you know, between understanding my powerlessness and seeing how these people deal with their powerlessness, I've learned a lot of lessons about how to kind of handle yourself in environments like that.
They definitely put all their faith, hope, and trust in the Lord.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's nothing else that they have, literally, other than themselves and God.
I felt on that first trip, especially going in, feeling like I was strong in my faith, realizing about 10 seconds into that trip, like, I don't know anything about
it. Yeah. Like,
compared to these people, like I have figured nothing out. So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I understand now that you're a husband and a father.
Yes.
So, you know, is that sort of impacted your willingness to maybe put yourself in some of these positions where you're having to dive into foxholes?
Yeah. Well, you know, thankfully, I think the situation in Sudan has changed some the past 2 years. So I haven't really had to think about those things too much. So in 2016, the part of Sudan we worked in, there was a ceasefire agreement signed, which has never been perfect. It's been broken a lot, but it did stop the aerial bombing, which was causing a lot of the problems.
Right.
And a lot of the large-scale fighting has essentially stopped. So things there are a lot quieter than they were in the early 2010s, I guess. So as I've become a husband and a dad, you know, our oldest is 6, our youngest three. Sudan has kind of quieted down with that, which sitting here talking about it, realizing what a blessing that is, I haven't even really had to think about that. Not because of COVID and obviously haven't been recently.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, as a dad, especially because we do so much work with education over there, you know, I always met parents over there before I was a dad who were so concerned about what their kids were going to grow up in.
Right.
And intellectually, I understood that. Yeah. But because I wasn't a dad,
right,
emotionally, I did have a hard time connecting to that.
Right.
But now I'm a dad and understanding that, you know, this world can be a dangerous place, and having kids who rely on dad and mom to take care of them and protect them. I have a much deeper appreciation for that responsibility, I would say.
Now, I do want to talk a little bit about your blog. You know, lots of people have blogs, and I wonder what motivated you to start the blog, and what sort of conversation are you hoping to facilitate via your blog?
Yeah, so, you know, I mentioned at the beginning, I grew up in a conservative evangelical background that leans more to the intellectual side. I think these past 5 or 6 years, just the political nature in the United States brought out the other side of evangelicalism a lot more. And, you know, I probably started departing conservative evangelicalism 10 years ago. I still found myself in a lot of those places.
Mm-hmm.
And I met, I knew a lot of people who were okay with what was happening politically here in the US. Mm-hmm. But I also knew a lot of people in those environments who were confused by it, who weren't okay with it, who were struggling in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, realizing that as I've kind of transitioned into much more ecumenical kind of love Jesus and your neighbor style of faith over the past 10 years. You know, I still kind of had my feet in both worlds to some degree, and felt like those people who were struggling and hurting, I you know, I can't answer questions for them. Those are questions they need to answer for themselves. But I can talk about my experiences kind of coming out of that. And I would say the past 2 years, especially as we've watched American evangelicalism just shatter for all kinds of reasons that have been boiling up for decades now. You know, just realizing like, you know, I'm in a position where I can help some people figure some things out, and I'm probably going to make some people mad along the way. Like I write about some things that evangelicals find very controversial, even though I don't find them.
So can you give me an example, like of one topic that an evangelical would find very controversial?
Sure. So, you know, kind of a mainstay of conservative evangelicalism is complementarian theology, which is, you know, men are only allowed to teach in the church and lead in the household. You know, I disagree with that. But I have seen in some cases where for some people, that's how they want to live their faith, and it actually does work.
Yes.
I have seen more of it not working.
Yes.
And it seems to be right now, you know, from the Southern Baptist Convention, all facets of evangelicalism, there's a lot of stories of sexual abuse coming out, of spirit, every type of abuse coming out. And it seems to have touched everyone but older white men. So women have been hurt by this, children have been hurt by this, younger white men have been hurt by this. And so that comes up a lot in my writing of trying to connect the dots between complementarian theology and the abuse that we're seeing. And you know, my belief that complementarian theology actually sets a lot of people up for failure, including the people who end up becoming abusers, because they're incentivized to engage in certain types of abuse sometimes. And for some, you know, that's made some people mad, which, you know, in our polarized age is to be expected to a certain degree. But I think it's also helped some people, kind of understand how oftentimes in evangelicalism, we separate orthodoxy from orthopraxy.
Yes. And so for our listeners, orthodoxy is what you believe, but orthopraxy is what you do, how you live your life.
And a lot of my writing, what comes up is showing that those two things are not only connected, but often connected in ways that we don't even understand ourselves.
I would agree.
And so that is just one issue that comes up a lot in my writing, and especially it seems to be younger evangelicals who have experienced some really nasty things said to them the past few years, or even worse forms of abuse. That's been able to speak into their lives, hopefully positively, and help them start thinking deeper about some of the things that they've been taught.
I definitely agree. I mean, I think your worldview absolutely affects how you move through the world. So, for example, if you really believe that God is fundamentally judgmental and vindictive and looking to zap you with every mistake that you make, you're likely to do that to others. But if your fundamental worldview is that God is gracious and loving and merciful and compassionate, and a God of second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth chances, not just for you, but everybody else, you're more likely to demonstrate that as you go through the world. You know, so I would say as someone who is a person with power and privilege in the church, you know, I and those who have authority and responsibility in the church in terms of leadership, we will be held accountable, I believe, by God for the ways in which we are shepherding God's flocks. And it's a scary responsibility. And I mean, I'm not perfect and nobody's perfect, but the teachings, the things that we say, the things that we teach, they have real life implications on people's lives.
And also understanding too that you know, people can hear from a pastor or someone like yourself on a Sunday, what are they listening to the other 6 days of the week?
That's true.
And that's something else that we've seen come up in evangelicalism in the past few years, especially, is a lot of, I think, genuinely good-hearted evangelical pastors realizing like, actually, these people come and listen to me on Sunday, but the other 6 days of the week, they're listening to conservative talk radio.
Exactly.
And not just conservative talk radio, but like the far right extreme. And But, you know, when you start thinking about the power dynamics in the church and what are we really being discipled by? I think when we start thinking more deeply about those things, I think it doesn't really matter what faith tradition you're in inside Christianity, you're going to probably start seeing some things that are concerning or that you don't like.
So. Of course. And I think that COVID has really stripped away the facade of a lot of things, including bad practices in the church. And we've known that the church needed to be reformed for a while. And COVID has just really pushed us into that. And so as difficult as COVID has been and as much suffering as there's been, we have a real opportunity. And not every generation can say the decisions that we make could have a fundamental impact on the future of Christianity or whatever your faith tradition is. But I think in our generation, that is the case. And so while it's really hard, it's also very exciting to me to be a part of, in some small way, influencing the trajectory of the church.
Yeah, you know, you just said the word reformed. And
yes.
I think for a lot of people coming out of the environments I came out of, the word right now is deconstruction, which is breaking down everything we were taught.
Yes.
Is it like what was good there, what was bad there? Yes. How do we move forward as we question essentially reality
for lack of a better word, you're right.
But I, you know, the past few months especially, I've really been thinking, even looking back to the Protestant Reformation, and other times in history where the church has been in a lot of internal upheaval.
Yes.
And I can't escape the thought that we're in the beginnings of some sort of reformation, at least here in the United States.
I agree.
I think we're in kind of the tearing down phase and the examining phase right now. And I don't honestly know what's going to come after that. I don't think anyone does. But it is an exciting time to be a Christian who gets to participate that in some small way that, like, you know, what we do over the next 30 or 40 years in the American church is probably going to set the trajectory for at least another 100 years. And that is both exciting and kind of terrifying.
Exactly. Are you familiar with the author Phyllis Tickle?
I'm not.
She was an Episcopal laywoman, actually, from here in Memphis. And she wrote a book several years ago called The Great Emergence.
Okay.
And her hypothesis is roughly every 500 years in the church, there's a major transition in the secular world that has unintended consequences on the future of the church.
Sure.
So you just mentioned the Protestant Reformation.
Yeah.
You know, there were priests all throughout Europe not happy with the Catholic Church, writing individual letters.
Yeah.
But when Martin Luther sort of did, you know, nailed that letter on the door of that church in Germany, Gutenberg had created the printing press.
Yeah.
And because that letter got mass produced, it spread all over Europe, which then has led to the proliferation of Christian denominations. And so today, I think if Phyllis Tickle were alive, she would argue the development of the internet and the computers that we carry in our pockets, which are cell phones. Mm-hmm. There was no thought about the church when that technology was developed. But just by definition, right, the fact that we have multiple radio stations and television stations, and you can basically just listen to one particular worldview your whole life. I can remember when I was a girl, everybody listened to Walter Cronkite or Dan Rather. And I remember when Barbara Walters was the first woman, you know, anchor on the news. At least we had a consistent source of news. And now there are so many different voices out there that it's having a major impact on the church. So that might be a book that you would be interested in, perhaps our listeners as well, The Great Emergence. And I think we're absolutely in that era.
We are almost exactly 500 years after the process.
Yes, we are. And she argued it's every 500 years. Yep. Well, Mark, if someone listening would be interested in getting more involved with the work of Operation Broken Silence, how can they learn about opportunities?
So the first place to go is just obsilence.org. That's our website where you can learn about our programming, all the ways you can give. Like a lot of nonprofits, we have some kind of involved opportunities like volunteering and events that we're not really doing right now,
right,
because of COVID. But there's still a lot of ways to get plugged in, from fundraising online to donating to programs. It's also a great place to just learn about Sudan.
Right.
As you know, it is an ancient place. It is a complicated place. And even on our website, we still only scratch the surface of what's happening there and why things are happening there. You also just search for Operation Broken Silence on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You know, we're on all the main social media platforms.
Right. So I wonder, in conclusion, you know, there's been so much with COVID and our political system and a lot of negative things in the world in the past few years. And I wonder, you know, what's giving you a sense of joy and hopefulness in your own life, your own faith journey, even in the midst of some really challenging things that we're dealing with?
Yeah, I would say two things. The first is the God and the Jesus we see in the Gospels.
Yeah.
You know, we see our Lord going to the people who are hurting and the people who are broken and just being with them.
Yeah.
And I think if we've learned anything the past few years, we cannot place enough value on that style of just meeting people where they are. And so that's been an encouragement to me. But, you know, also on the other side of that, I have seen a lot of Christians very quietly from all different backgrounds, conservative to progressive, and everything in between, trying to take that same approach. We don't see that in the news a lot. we don't see that online a lot. A lot of that's happening very quietly. But seeing so other believers in a time of political and health crisis, trying to help as many people as they can get through this. You know, I'd say heading into COVID, I was probably depressed.
Yeah.
Just the nature of everything that's happened the past few years. But and we saw a lot of ugliness during 2020 especially. But you know, I was really maybe even privileged to see a lot of Christians saying, like, I'm done with the negativity, I'm done with fighting, like, I'm gonna try to live for Jesus and I'm gonna mess up a lot along the way, but I'm gonna try to make this work. And that has given me a lot of hope, of like, God is not done with the American church, whether it's evangelical or Episcopal or Catholic, whatever it
exactly.
is, he's not done.
So. Excellent. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your faith journey and your willingness to really live your faith in concrete ways, and many blessings on your ministry moving forward.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to another edition of Faithfully Memphis. Just a reminder that you can listen to this podcast on any platform where you listen to other podcasts, including Spotify and Apple Music. So we encourage you to listen and also to like us or follow us. And please do tune in next Thursday, December 23rd, when we will be bringing you a wonderful concert, the Rhodes College 35th Annual Christmas at St. Mary's Concert, which was actually held on December the 5th. We will be broadcasting that on December 23rd. Beautiful music to get you in the holiday mood. So until next week, stay positive and stay healthy.